Welcome to Nexus 818 Podcast, a reflective platform for connecting past successes with future progress in the African American community. I'm your host, Doc JC. The inaugural season of Nexus 818 Podcast focuses on the 6888 Central Postal Directory Battalion, the only Women's Army Corps unit designated as African American to serve in the European Theater of Operations during World War II. If you're tuning into the podcast for the very first time, I encourage you to check out the inaugural episode from September the 7th of 2022 to learn about the background of the 6888 Battalion. I am pleased to welcome to episode 12, the descendant of Private First Class, Crescencia Garcia, who served in the 6888. My guest tonight is Tara Garcia, granddaughter of Crescencia Garcia. Welcome, Tara.
Thank you, Doc. Very, very happy to be here.
I'd like to start with a few interesting facts. First, your grandmother, Crescencia, will be 103 years old in April and is one of the last six living 6888 soldiers. And second, of the 855 soldiers, she was the only Afro-Latina in the 6888. And she experienced quite a bit of colorism during her time in the Army. And we're going to talk a bit more about that later. So let's go back to the very beginning to talk about where she started. She was born in Puerto Rico, where she had a lot of struggles. At the age of 19, she took a boat to come to New York. Tell us about her early days and her decision to come to the mainland.
Well, from what I understand, because this is all sort of passed along to me, she was born in Maunabo, Puerto Rico. She had a brother and a sister, but being the oldest, she was responsible for everyone else. I know at one point that she was, so they were born to her mother, and they all had the same father, but they were illegitimate. And it wasn't until much later on that the father decided to claim them and actually give them his last name. Moving along, she was sent over to a relative's house, to her godmother's house, and was tasked with sort of chores around the house, cleaning, cooking, that kind of thing, because her mother couldn't afford to keep her in the house. And it's not the future she actually envisioned for herself. And she believed very, very much in the power of education. Truly wanted to move forward and to stay in school. But that wasn't supported by this godmother who was sort of in charge of her life at the time. Fast forward just a little bit, and she went back to live with her mom, and enrolled in high school, and was there for about 2 years. And after year two, just because money was really, really, really tight, and she had to figure out a way to maintain for the family, she decided to go over to New York. At the time, you know, there was a huge diaspora from the island. There were no jobs on the island. And she did what many people her age and of the time did, which was get on a boat and make her way over to New York City. And while she was on this boat, she met a merchant marine who became a lifelong sort of family friend. But this merchant marine was very, very kind to her. And he asked her, where are you going? And she's like, I don't know. I'm going to New York, but I have no idea what I'm doing after that. And he said, well, I've got a sister. And she already lives there. And her name is Candita. And she lives in the Bronx. So why don't you, here's her address, look her up, and connect with her and see how she can sort of help you navigate the things. Well, Grandma gets here. She gets to the Bronx. She meets Candita. Candita says, sure, you can hang out with me, stay with me for as long as you need to. So she moved in, and Candita helped her find a job in a sewing factory, learning how to do the things. And she had always sewn sort of like around the house, mended and darned things. But she was a very, very quick study. And so she got a job in a local sewing factory. And she learned how to use specific machine making buttonholes, which was, you know, it was piecework, right? You got paid for every single buttonhole that you made. But she was able to put her money away because Gandita didn't really request much of her while she was staying with her. She just helped around the house. And with the money that she saved from this job, she was able to get her family out of Puerto Rico and into an apartment in the Bronx while she continued to stay with Gandita. So she stayed with Gandita. She found a spot for them. They moved into that apartment and she paid for that. And eventually they all lived together.
That was a real blessing to meet somebody like that.
I mean, this is how this happened, right? You hear about these stories all the time. And, you know, when you watch documentaries or even just envisioning this story here, I just, you have a lot of time on this boat, right? It's not like it's super speed engines and it's not like you're on a flight for 3 hours and you take off and you land. There's a lot of time in between. And the fact that you're sort of, you know, meeting other people and there's so much uncertainty on this passenger manifest, as it were, because a lot of people are going to a place that they've never even been to before. And so if you're all literally speaking in the same boat, there's that community that forms before you even get off. And I think that's it's part of the immigrant experience that I think is missed by many Puerto Ricans in general, just because there's always this understood statehood or citizenship, I should say, that's granted to us. But people forget that there is an absolute immigrant experience involved in all of this. And so it's just really interesting to hear.
Mm-hmm. So how old was she when she decided to enlist?
When she enlisted, it was 1944. So let me see. She was born in 1920. So 24. Yeah. There you go.
Okay. So at that time she was doing the piecemeal work and
she was doing the piecework. Sewing in the garment district.
So what did she tell you about why she decided to enlist?
Well, that was interesting because her lifelong dream was actually to become a nurse, right? She was good at sewing and it was a means to an end, but ultimately she wanted to be a nurse. But the problem there is she wasn't able to finish high school. So she didn't have the proper education. She didn't even have a high school diploma. But there was a program in Lincoln Hospital, the old Lincoln Hospital in the Bronx, where it was sort of like medic training, as it were. And they told her, like, look, you don't have the education to become a nurse, but come join this medic training. And she started to do that. And she really, really enjoyed it. And she learned quite a bit. And then Pearl Harbor happens. You know, the way she tells it, you know, she's like, you know, the whole country just stopped what they were doing. And everyone was in sort of shock and dismay. But the one thing that rose to the top is just like, okay, we've got to defend this country. We have to do what we can. We're hurt. The country's hurt. And how is it that we can rally and help? And she had just been hearing a buzz that, you know, women could help in the war effort. So she went to an office to figure out how it is that she could help.
So it's a sense of patriotism.
Absolutely. Which to this day is still alive and well. But I will say that if there is one central theme in any Garcia of she and my grandfather in any line of our family, it's patriotism. It is always been alive and well, but it's very, very strong sentiment that we have. We're very, very patriotic.
Now, how did her mother was over here at the time. So how did her mother react to her decision to enlist?
Well, part of enlistment was also you get a paycheck. Right? Like this was also steady work. But the biggest draw, I think, too, for my grandmother in understanding what it is that she might be able to do while she was there is potentially put her medic skills to work. So it would be more closely aligned to what it is that she wanted to do. And her mother's extremely supportive. You know, it's like she realized that, okay, she's not going to be in the front line. She's not going to have a gun in her hand. And while she might be away from us, the fact of the matter was that she'd still be able to take care of her. And I think at that point, her daughter had already brought her over. So she had faith that, you know, she was making decisions for herself. She'd made decisions for the family. She was able to bring them over. So, you know, she entrusted her with whatever was going to happen next.
Okay. But it was still pretty courageous for a young Afro-Latina to enlist in the army in the 40s. What do you think made it special?
I just really need to emphasize that every time I talk about this with someone, I'm still blown away by her bravery, her chutzpah, right? Like she just, I'm like, what? There's no way in the world. Not that I wouldn't want to serve my country in some way, shape, or form, but I think to me, the bigger part of this is you leave this little island that you're a part of, then you come to this country, you go to New York, which in and of itself is
So
intimidating.
you get on a boat, you're not sure where you're going, you don't have any place to stay.
York. New York is bananas, right? Born, raised, never left. New York is bananas. And then she's in the middle of all this. And okay, Pearl Harbor happens. So now not only are you gonna enlist, you're gonna go to boot camp, which has always scared the heck out of me. You're gonna go to boot camp. And then from boot camp, you're probably gonna be shipped to Europe or wherever things are happening. And I'm just like, what a sense of adventure, no fear, no fear. And just I think so it's a call. She's answering this sort of patriotic call, but I just think that she loved an adventure. And when, even as her granddaughter, even as she, as my grandmother, there wasn't a road trip she didn't want to take. There wasn't, you know what I mean? So like, I get it, you know what I mean? And I saw sort of a modified version of that much later in her life, but this all tracks, it's all on brand for her.
Well, that's a common thread. As I've talked to other descendants, they said that, that spirit of adventure is very, very strong.
I
So
get
I guess you have to be when you decide, you to make that decision. So you have to be somewhat fearless to do that. I'm interested in any stories that she shared about her time in the service, any adventures or painful or scary or funny memories. And I want to start off by talking about this whole issue of the impact of colorism. You described to me situations where she lived in constant limbo, feeling like she really didn't belong. So tell me about how she ended up in the 6888 unit and what her experiences were like as an Afro-Latina.
So I'm going to preface all of this by saying that she never talked about any of this. And I have found out about all of this in the last 2.5 to 3 years. Never spoke about her service. We knew she was a veteran. There was her sort of army picture posted up next to grandpa's army picture with an American flag on the wall above it. And I just understood that she was a veteran, and that's the extent of it. Never asked her, thought it was great, cool. Not very many people around me's grandmothers were veterans from World War II. So it was just like, okay, cool. But she never talked about it. And it wasn't until we understood her affiliation with the 6888 that she started to sort of like come clean about what her experiences were. And the thing is, I think we just, no one ever thought to ask. And so as we started to do that is when the stories came out. So generally speaking, she decides to join. And when I ask her about this, so she decides to join and they do the unit assignment. And they mentioned to her that she's going to be in a segregated unit. To this day, she doesn't remember the unit number. It's not something that's, she never, it was her unit. She went, and when she got to basic, and she's looking around her and she's like, oh, wait a minute. Okay, cool. Like, so I'm being put in this unit that is segregated. I don't see any white people here. And I am Puerto Rican and I see a lot of black women and I'm being put with the black women. And she got it because of her skin color, she understood that, but it didn't. When you talk to her about it now, there's a thing in coming from Puerto Rico where you're just Puerto Rican, and it's, I'm not saying that there's not colorism on the island, that's another conversation. But where she was from, she just had very small experiences on the island, but all in all, everybody around you is Puerto Rican. So it's homogenous that way. And in that we're all the same nationality. So she just didn't see the difference. And then she gets to New York and the people she surrounds herself with are other Boricuas, other Puerto Ricans. And So she's like, okay, I'm one of these people. And then she gets to the US and it's like, oh, it's a subjugation of the other, right? So it's just like, we've got this, but then you belong here. And so it was the first time she'd been categorized. So she gets to this unit and she does as she's told, as you do. But what happens then, now she's in the unit, and from her experiences, she was in this weird no man's land, because obviously there were no there were no white wacks, and then all the other wacks were black, but she was lighter than everyone else, right? Than most, not mm-hmm. all, but than right. most. But also too, last name is Garcia, so she wasn't necessarily embraced by the black wax. And so when I talked to her about, I said, you know, so like, did you have a lot of friends? Like, what did you do? And she was like, uh-uh. She's like, I felt like I didn't belong anywhere. I was in a no man's land. So like, whether it was basic or even when they went overseas, she says, I spent a lot of time reading on my own. I kept to myself. I didn't really go out with very many people. I navigated everything by myself because I really wasn't embraced. It was a very strange place for her to be. Yeah.
So did she make any friends at any subsequently?
It's weird.
At any point?
Yeah. So she, when I asked her about that, she says there were a couple of people who gave her advice. And would say, maybe you should do this, or maybe you shouldn't do that, or, you know, come with me, because that's not the way to do that, or whatever. It's sort of like advice, but she had no like friends. She had no like no, she didn't make any buddies while she was there. It was different when she was in England. Because, well, and I'll get to that in a second, but it was very different in the US versus once they got overseas.
Okay. Talk about that. I should say.
Yeah, of course. Well, she was just treated differently in Europe.
Treated differently, because every reason I asked that is because most of the soldiers in general said they were treated better as African Americans in Europe than they were treated in the United States. So was that her experience, or was she? So that's why I was just.
Absolutely.
Curious.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think if she had her did this, she never would have left Europe. But right. She had family to come back to. But everyone was so, they were so wonderful to her, and they embraced her. And so they, she gets to, they get to England, and everyone's sort of like figuring out what their job or their role is because of her background as a medic training, I should say. They were like, you know what? You're best served helping us in burn units. We're going to take you to Whitchurch, England. And that's what you're going to do. You're going to help out, you know, injured soldiers and burning unit soldiers. Okay, cool. So she gets there and she says the nurses, the doctors, like there was never, essentially, race never came up for them. They were like, you're an extra set of hands. A lot of respect because she was from the US and she was in uniform. It's like, okay, cool. You're here to help us. Like, we're helping each other. This is a joint effort. And she worked alongside them and she made fast friends. It's weird. I have, and you know, I've not said this to anyone, but I have a picture of her with another WAC, and the WAC looks white. And they must have taken leave or something. And it's a picture of her in this white wag, and they're chilling. Because, and I say that because it's in a frame, and the frame is a Brazilian frame, and it's a keepsake from Brazil. And I'm just like, wait a minute, did you have leave? Did you go on vacation to Brazil? Who is this white wag? I'm very confused. So I've got to get to the bottom of that.
Was language an issue for her? And that was that a. Do you think that might have been a factor? Is that a factor as well as colorism, or?
You know, it's weird because.
Or is it just they just kind of intersected?
I would say that. So even to this day, my grandmother has an accent, but I mean, she pursued the English language feverishly because she knew that it was what it was going to take to be able to navigate. But yeah, English as a second language, right? So she's got this thick Spanish accent. But I also, too, I would imagine if you're in England, you're dealing with Spaniards as well at some point in your life. So it's not unheard of that someone has a language, especially if you're in England per se. Everyone else has an accent, right? Everyone
Right.
not English speaking. So I don't think that was as much of a factor for her there, but was it a factor down south?
Right.
Of course it was. Yeah.
Right. Right. So she went to basic in Iowa.
So she was in Des Moines,
Right.
and then she went to Midland, Texas.
Texas. Okay. And then
Okay.
she went to Fort, is that where she got her overseas training, or did she go to Fort Oglethorpe?
She went to Oglethorpe.
Yeah, I think that's where they did all of this. So, what did she do when she completed her military service? When she came back.
When she came back, she sailed on a ship called the Arcadia. There's so much research I have to do around all this stuff because I want to see like pictures of this ship and I'm so curious about all of it. But anyway, so she went back to her friend Candita in the Bronx. And there was a lady who lived downstairs. And she was like, okay, so you want to get back in the workforce. There is a factory in the Bronx that I've been working at. I'll bring you with me. We'll see if we can get you a gig. And she did, she got the job right away. And she'd learned so much prior to the war at that other place that she was working at that she knew how to work most of the machines. And they were like, okay, cool, come on board. And they hired her. And then, she was there for a little bit and they were like, you know what? Like, you'll make more money if you work in the city. So let's get a job in Manhattan. And sure enough, she went down to Manhattan. She spoke to a factory foreman. And they hired her and she started working in a union shop. She joined the ILGW and she started working in a union factory and stayed there until she retired. And she was a seamstress. She went from a seamstress to a cutter, from a cutter to a pattern maker, and everything in between. She was a union delegate. Like that was her jam until she left. And she made every outfit or dress of mine for every significant occasion in my life, minus my wedding. Because by the time my wedding came around, because I was so old by the time I got married, she couldn't do that anymore. But and then she parlayed that into what she did for the church. So she is very, very involved in her church. She was a Eucharistic minister, but she also helped with the church vestments, right? So creating the vestments for the priests, creating the tablecloths that went on the altar, all the beautiful sort of like additions around the church for different masses for the seasons and such. And she was very, very involved in that. And I mean, it's a church, right? And there are all these events. So she made everyone's sweet 16 or quinceañera dress. She made everyone's wedding dress. She made her son and daughter-in-law's the whole wedding party that was all made by her. Like there was nothing she didn't do. She even worked at a factory at one point that made umbrellas. And I had an umbrella for every outfit. As a 7-year-old, I was quite dapper.
Was she able to take advantage of the GI Bill when she came home?
No.
Okay.
She just chose not to go down that path. And I don't know why it is because I mean, she's smart as a whip but like that just wasn't for her. Her whole thing was like, okay, I'm back. I still have a mom and a sister to take care of because they're sort of they really can't figure it out on their own. And it was just the obligation to make the money right away. I just don't think that she saw it as an option for herself.
Well, some people use the GI Bill for education, obviously, but some also use it to buy homes. That was
Yeah.
why I asked. Yeah. Okay. It's hard to buy a home in New York, even with a GI Bill. So when she returned home, did she experience any special challenges as a Puerto Rican veteran?
I mean, no, it's just so you integrate back into society, and then no one ever really assumes that you were a veteran because you're a
Okay.
woman. And
Right.
it was never discussed, minus her chats with her boyfriend, then husband, right? Because that's the thing that they had in common. My grandfather served in World War II. And it was, I mean, I would imagine it's something pretty cool to have in common with this guy that you start dating. It's like, oh yeah, you serve? Cool, so did I. And he's probably like, what? And yeah, and then they met and they were married a year later, and they had my dad and his siblings. But I would imagine that when you asked me a little bit earlier about sort of like the things that she faced in terms of colorism and such, and it's one thing to be an island among your unit members, but it's another thing to go on leave, or, you know, you're given, let's say, 6 hours of just like free time and you want to go grab something to eat, and you're in Georgia and you get on a bus and a white woman on the bus says, "Why are you sitting here? Get out of my seat. Please go to the back of the bus," which happened to her. Absolutely. Or when she went to go to a restaurant and she wasn't served, and they told her she had to go back out back to eat. Yeah, a lot of that stuff. And I think that's why she didn't talk about it, because when she brings it up now, she's still enraged. And I do not blame her. But it was just those little things, because remember, you're from New York and Puerto Rico, then New York, and then you go down south, and it's just the world's a whole different experience than it is in the Northeast. And I'm not saying things didn't exist in the Northeast, but the tensions were palpable, and it was just something she had never confronted before.
Well, the interest, it's always interesting to me to talk to people who grew up in the North. Because even a decade and a half later, those same things were going on in the South. So I grew up in Georgia, and those same experiences with the restrooms and the restaurants and the theaters, they hadn't changed.
I'm sure.
So yeah. Mm-hmm. So do you recall any lessons that she learned through her service that she passed along to the family? Are there any values and traditions that you pass along as a consequence of her service in the 6888?
Again, she really didn't talk about the fact that she served, but there was this ongoing argument between she and my grandpa, because not an argument, but he would tease her because he had more bars than she did, more stripes as it were. And like, she was furious about it, and it would get her goat every single time. And of course, I've never been in the service. I don't get these things. I'm just like, why are they fighting again? And I'd hear them, or like, you know, I could hear him saying it out loud to her. That's why I have more stripes than you, or whatever. I'm just like, Grandpa, what are you talking about? That was a really long time ago. And so that theme, that recurring theme came up. But beyond that, it was, like I said, just patriotism. So like, we would take like family road trips to Gettysburg, because it was important for us to learn military history, right? And so she took, and this is a generation before me, she would take my dad and his brother and her daughter, and they did the it was almost like a pilgrimage, as it were, to Gettysburg, just to see the things there. And then she did it with me when I was younger. And all of those things are really important. She just wanted us to have a perspective on, let's say, battles that were fought on this soil. And then in her house, she had American flags everywhere. And then, you know, when my grandfather passed away, he had a military service, and, you know, she got his flag, and it was inside they put it inside the case. And it was like this beautiful little shrine, as it were, in her apartment. And it was there, and then their pictures are underneath it. But also too, as evidenced by my father's and my uncle's choices to enlist in the service. And, you know, at the time that they were coming of age, Vietnam was hot. Everything was on and popping. And so what I love about those guys is that, you know, they didn't wait to get drafted. They enlisted and they served. And both of my grandparents were very, very proud of them. And so, as it were, sort of like a tradition, a military tradition, as it were. And then, you know, 4th of July was very important to us. There were pictures of me holding flags. You know, it was like the photo op moment. But it was one of those things, like, just don't ever forget where you came from. And it's wild, because this is a woman who was born and raised in Puerto Rico. But I got the sense, while she loves her island, this is her country. And make no mistake, you know, and it's just weird, because I thought for sure that there'd be a deeper connection to the island through her. But both from she and my grandfather, like the US was it, and this is what we fought for, and this is what your father fought for, and this is what your uncle fought for, or uncles, and like this is your country, so respect it, love it. And then, you know, they all went into law enforcement. My uncle and my aunt and my dad. And so another level of that is, okay, cool. So, you know, we're here to protect and serve. And I think that's the common theme more than anything else is, yeah, patriotism and civic duty.
Okay, those are very important.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned your grandfather Esteban,
Yes.
and that he was in the service in the army also. You told me that his unit was involved in the largest loss of life in U.S. maritime history. So he wasn't in the army. He
No,
was in.
he was in
Okay.
the army. Yeah. So it's interesting. It's the largest loss of life in maritime military history, not
Okay.
necessarily naval, but maritime military history. So yeah, no, he was a cook in the army, and he was part of the unit that was helping to build the Burma Way.
Okay.
And so they had to take a ship. I forgot where they left from, but they were on their way to Karachi. And it was a really, really hot, as you can imagine, they're getting closer and closer to Asia. And it was a really, really hot night. And as a cook, you're way down below typically, and you sleep way down below. And he was feeling claustrophobic. So he said, "You know what? Tonight I'm sleeping on deck." And that's the same night that they got torpedoed by a German submarine. And had he been below deck, I wouldn't be here. But thankfully, he was above deck, and the cargo ship was blown to smithereens.
Wow.
Very few survivors, and he was floating out in the ocean for I don't know what he was holding on to. But he had a deal with God, and he said, "God, if I get out of this okay, I am going to name my daughter after this cargo ship," because I think it was a piece of the ship that he was hanging on to. Cargo ship was the Rona, which is his daughter's name, my aunt Rona. Yeah, and so it's crazy though, right? They get rescued, and you would think, oh my goodness, like you just went through this crazy, horrific, traumatizing thing. Yeah, no, come on, here's another ship. Let's go. We have a way to build, and we need you to cook the things, and that's what he did. And so he kept on going, and come to find out that there's so few survivors of the Rona. And I want to say 2 or 3 years ago, they made a documentary about them, which I have yet to see. Someone reached out to us because they found his name. Because they saw the article on my grandmother, and they were like, "Wait a minute, this name, the Rona, Esteban Garcia, his name is on this list." Boom, he's gone now, but he obviously survived the things. And so, I think it's just tremendous, right? Like they were both in really unique wartime situations for themselves. I'm not like there's all kinds of crazy stories coming out of World War II. People have served in the most incredible ways. It is indeed the greatest generation. I just think it's funny how two people who are standing in the Bronx post-war, him still in his uniform because he didn't have, you know, clothes really to his name. So everybody was walking around in their stuff. And she, I think at the time was working at a like a he was working at the candy store. He was working at the candy store, and a friend introduced them, whatever. They started dating. But I guess, can you imagine one of those dates where they're sitting around? So, you know, what did you do while you were out there? Oh, you know, just, you know, taking care of soldiers that had been burned, whatever. Some of them POWs. Really? What did you do? Well, there was this whole thing on the Rona. And I said, can you imagine that first date? And I'm just like, how did it come from these human beings? These are people who are not just survivors, but they managed to thrive because I tell you right now, as the granddaughter of these humans, I never got the sense that grandpa had any PTSD or that mama, like they were just, you know, they were like bicker among each other, but he was the most doting and gentle and wonderful grandfather. And she was still a badass and out there making her money, but making sure that like we went on vacation and we did things. And I was just like, who? But you're like secret agents, right? You have this whole other life. They're amazing.
Yep.
Yeah.
As we know them, it's hard to envision them as they were then, you know. And we have to give them the props, you know.
Oh my goodness, yeah. And the other thing I'll say really quickly is the thing that dawned on me as this all came to be was Grandma was 24 when she enlisted. War went on for how many years?
It ended in 46, I believe.
Let's say 3 years.
Yeah.
She gets out, she's 27. That's old. By today's standards, that's old to not be married.
Right.
And in my brain, I'm like, the whole time that she was in the service and then leading up to her enlisting, she was single. She was a single woman providing, had a job, goes out there, goes to Europe. From what I understand, she befriended, which is a whole other story, but she befriended a Tuskegee Airman. They were very good friends. She met him while she was over there. She had his picture tucked away. She even had his dog tags.
Yes, yes.
And it's beautiful. And we were able to actually connect with his family because of the dog tags. And so it's so interesting to now see her through the lens of a single woman making things happen. It's something that I identify fiercely with.
But a woman of color in the 40s.
Yes,
doing
the, that's what I'm saying.
Yes, yes.
I think I just took for granted my ability to navigate in the world that way, where she did it when it was unheard of. This is what I'm saying. She gets back, she's 27, she's not married, she doesn't have children. So how are people looking at her? How are they dealing with her? And certainly the societal pressures from the people around her, from her community, right? What was that like to navigate? And sure enough, I mean, fine, she met her soulmate and, you know, they got married and they did the things, but like, up until that point, she was the boss of her. And it's pretty impressive to look at it that from that perspective.
And that is why they have so many independent offsprings. That's why so many of the daughters and granddaughters are so fiercely independent.
Amen.
So let's segue and talk about your background. So you are a talent acquisition specialist for Vice Media, and have been in advertising for 22 years, and your passion is documentary photography. So tell me about your educational and career background.
Sure. I've hung my hat within the advertising space for the last 22 years. Prior to that, I was in healthcare for 10. I'm a graduate of Hunter College, City University of New York, stand-up CUNY. Ooh. I'm the daughter of a CUNY graduate. We are CUNY kids. And I stumbled into advertising accidentally. It's been fantastic. It's been a fantastic journey. But one of the things, my coming into this industry, in the very beginning, there were huge conversations around diversity, equity, and inclusion within the advertising space because it just was non-existent, essentially. And so I entered the industry at a really interesting time because it was a bit of a reckoning. And there was a committee put together and agencies were sort of put on the spot and fines were being assessed because they were being asked to show their numbers to understand what their diversity looked like within the ranks. And it was pretty abysmal. However, the agency that I landed in had already taken steps to rectify those things, which was kind of amazing. And I worked with, at the time, a diversity manager, which I didn't even know what that was. They'd hired her, that she was the first person in that role at the agency. And I was a creative manager at the time and was busy wrangling creatives, hiring creatives, you know, sort of air traffic control for the creatives, but I had one foot on the diversity track, you know, helping her out in her new role, just understanding the things. And it's just something that became really important to me because I started to understand what the impact of messaging was or wasn't when you had the right people in the room to make those decisions and or to create that creative. And so knowingly, unknowingly, I never became I was never hired as a DEI specialist. That's not something that I did, because I was very focused on this sort of creative management, resource management track, because that's just the way that my brain works. But I couldn't help, as a Latina in the industry, I couldn't help but see the world through a specific lens. And so as I was hiring creative talent, it was never lost on me that I bumped into advertising. I didn't choose it as a career path. I took a temp job at an advertising agency, and I got there and I looked around and I was just like, what the hell is this? Like, people are playing with toys and they're throwing Nerf balls around, and there's closets full of beer and chocolate and candy, because these were their big accounts. And I was just like, wait a minute, like, how come I didn't know about this? Because I absolutely would have taken the shortcut and gone right into this from college, but I just didn't realize that this existed. And so I made it a point from that point on to make sure that those doors were open, that those options were there for people just coming out of school. And so it's the lens with which I use for hiring, because that's just what I do, but it's also information for my hiring managers and the sort of the executives that I am adjacent to make sure that I bring them along on this journey, so that the industry looks different. Has it changed much in 22 years? It's a little better, but no, it's like everything else in the world. It's like everything else in our country. Like, there are baby steps. And while it's lovely to see chief creative officers and executive creative directors of color in seat, to date, if I'm not mistaken, there were only 7 Black ECDs in the entire industry still. So there's work to be done.
For the audience, the ECD is
an executive creative director. So that is the top honcho at an agency who's making creative decisions, but also has such a huge influence in hiring and setting a tone, and creating a safe space for people of color who are also entering the industry underneath them.
Okay, great. So, you know, I have a keen interest in photography myself. So you recently did an exhibit. What fuels your love for photography?
Oh my gosh, funny story. So there was a small suitcase filled with family pictures. And I just decided to go through them one day. And one of them flipped out and sort of like fell on the floor on its back. And I picked it up and I look at it, and there's a stamp on the back. And the stamp says, Esteban Garcia Fine Photography, East 138th Street, Bronx, New York. And I'm like, wait a minute, that's my grandfather's name. I think that's where they lived when my dad was young. And I'm like, a stamp? This is Fine Photography. So I call my father. I said, Dad, what's the significance to this address? And he's like, yeah, that's where they first lived. He's like, and that's where I lived when I was born. I was like, oh, okay. And I said, but then how come grandpa has a stamp? He says, oh, because he was an amateur photographer. So he turned a closet into a dark room, and he would do portraiture for people on the block and people in the neighborhood. And he was the guy that they went to. And so it's like, oh, now I know why I have always been a shutterbug. So like, my parents bought me a camera when I was very young. And then that transitioned to a Leclic, which was just, again, a film camera, but everything was like colorized in the late 80s. I would take my camera to school. I took pictures of all my classmates. Like, I was never without a camera in my hand. So I liken myself to sort of, I like to say that I'm sort of like my family historian, as it were. And then cell phones come out, and then you have access to this camera consistently. And there's not a moment where I'm not looking at the world through that lens per se. And so fast forward, as a very proud Bronx native, I've recently left the Bronx, but I'm not too far. I always had a problem with people's perception of the borough. It's the Bronx has a bad rap. She's been through some stuff. She's burnt down to the ground. But she's in a bit of a renaissance, as it were, at this point. But there are many people who have just always been there and have never given up. And I just wanted everyone to see the Bronx through a different lens. And so there was just a hashtag that I started called My Bronx is Beautiful, with the hopes that I could just bring people along for the journey and say, like, I know you know this about the Bronx, but do you know this about the Bronx? Do you know that the largest park in New York City is based in the Bronx? Do you know that there's an incredible mansion called the Bartow Pell Mansion that that's a turn of the century home, and it has all these beautiful architectural details? Do you know about what slavery looked like at Van Cortlandt Park? Do you know? And it's just all those things. So I, as a, I don't know, as a wannabe historian to the Bronx, and my love of it, and then I married that with photography, and I just started taking all these pictures. So I do a lot of street photography, some landscape pictures. I haven't done portraiture, but all in all, I think I feel like it's my responsibility to just document the world around me.
Hey, black and white or color or both?
Both.
Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. All right. So now, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying it's so much fun, and it's also a release for me, right? Like, I'm not thinking about anything else when I'm in my zone and I'm taking pictures. I'm not thinking about anything else, and it gives me just like this zen moment, which I think we all need.
So tell us a little bit about your exhibit from yesterday.
I shared an exhibit with a friend, a neighbor of mine, Lewis, and it's a lovely church in Westchester called Christ the Redeemer, and they have an artist ministry. So essentially it's a way for the church to shine the light on local artists and also make a little money for the church as well. And so 20% of the proceeds of the photographs that are sold go to the church. So we had our opening yesterday, and I had friends come from far and wide. I even had someone come from Pennsylvania. God love her. Just to hang out with me for a couple of hours. And I sold a few, which is really lovely. And they're going to be up for the rest of the month. And I tried to keep my focus in terms of what I was showing on a lot of the Bronx work. Some of it is like from Puerto Rico and such in my travels, but most of it is Bronx focused because where I'm showing is actually adjacent to the Bronx. So it's lovely to give people in that neighborhood some context.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's been great.
Yeah. So yesterday was the first day you sold any of your work?
I curated a gallery at my old ad agency years ago. And the last exhibit that we did before they changed sort of like how they were using the space was my own work. I had the gall to say, you know what? I take pictures. Let me put myself up here, and I actually sold like three pieces then. But that was back in 2007, I want to say. So it's been a really long time.
It's nice to get back into the area, the field. So
it really is.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about influence. You've described your grandmother as fiercely independent and a 5'4" force of nature, which is a very interesting and intriguing description. So how have you seen that manifested over the years?
You know, my parents are incredible people. I'm just going to put that out there. My mother, working mom all her life, and I never needed for anything. Dad held down 2 and 3 jobs sometimes. They put me to Catholic school. They were always very invested in me. So I am very much all of those things. And then this happens in terms of, you know, grandma getting sick, my call for prayers from people on Instagram, which turns into an interview with David Begnaud, which turns into all of this. And in all of the interviews now that grandma has been a part of.
So around the 6888.
Around the 6888, yeah.
Okay.
Just understanding that not only was she a veteran, but she was part of this incredible unit of women. And then listening to the stories of these other women that are part of the same unit, understanding what this unit was able to accomplish, understanding the conditions in which they accomplished all the things. It blew my mind. But then I took a beat and I said, okay, so this is where you come from. And I think we're on a course, all humans, as it were, to discover who we are. And may it always be the case. May you always seek, and may you always find. Some of us are satisfied with the bare minimum. And sometimes things are put in your lap where you're forced to really, really look at yourself and understand your lineage. And I think the other level to this is that she's still with me. So
and that's such a blessing.
I just don't understand it. And I'm grateful. And she doesn't understand it at this point either. She's just like, why are they asking me all these questions? And why am I still here? She's asked me that question quite a bit. But as she's being interviewed and as folks are asking her these questions, to hear her answers, to see her struggle at times because the memories are so painful, to see her speak of, you know, why she enlisted and to hear her take on, you know, Hitler and Hirohito, and to hear her talk about what she faced when she was in basic training, and to hear about, you know, what her experiences overseas were, and to hear it from her mouth, never described, not to me, not to her son, not to her daughter. She didn't talk about this with anyone. To hear it firsthand at this stage of my life, and then I can't imagine that she'd imagine that she'd be saying this or recounting these stories after she was 100 years old. So, like, I feel like I just met somebody brand new. And so how that manifests itself later on, for me, it's just like, okay, Tara, so we're living through some really extraordinary times. The world, what the world has been through in the last 5 years, let's just put that out there, right? Anytime you get a sense that you can't push through, anytime you get a sense that this is too hard, anytime you get a sense that, you know, oh, you know, COVID and pandemics, and, you know, she came out of the Spanish flu, right? Like, they've dealt with these things in her generation, and they know what that was, that what plague and pestilence looked like back then. And I think if you take all of those things, it's almost life looking at you in the face and begging you to A, understand what you're made of. B, you don't have an excuse. Never look for an excuse to not move forward, because you don't have one. Like, you just absolutely not. And then C, understanding that all of those sacrifices that she made were so that I could sit here and talk to you, tell you my perspective on things, and do so from a very blessed lived experience. Thanks to her, thanks to the son that she raised, and everything else in between. So, like, yeah, it's just helpful to know she's always been a badass. She's always been tough as nails. She's always shown up for her family and, you know, done what she's had to do. But then you add this layer on top of it, and it's just like, oh, not only you made a big stuff, but so much is expected of you, Tara Jeanine. Like, so just push, keep on pushing, keep on going.
Yeah. Yep. It does. I mean, they provided such a foundation for us and motivation to achieve, and without excuse.
That's right.
Without excuse.
That's right.
Share any reflections on what her life and legacy mean to you and your family.
The amount of feedback I've received on anything that I've shared, either via social media or things that people have seen on the news or on Instagram, whatever. The feedback I've received. So just a really quick story. I went to get a new phone at the Apple store last summer. I walk in, I'm waiting for someone at the Genius Bar. They send a genius over to me, and we're in conversation about the phones. Someone comes over, a gentleman comes over with his daughter, and he stops me mid-sentence and he says, "I am so sorry to bother you." And he had a hat with a little Puerto Rican flag on it. He says, "I'm so sorry to bother you." He says, "But are you Crescencia Garcia's granddaughter?" And I said, "Yeah." Stop. And I look around. I was just like, where am I right now? Like, what's happening? And he says, I just want to tell you that I sat down with my family and we saw the interview with your grandmother a week ago, whatever it was. And she validated my service. She validated my experience as someone in, as a Puerto Rican in the armed forces in this country. Not only that, though, but my daughter, who was standing next to him, my daughter was able to see this. And now that gives her an example of what it's like to be a strong Boricua. And his daughter came over to me and she said, please thank your grandmother for her service. And she was all of like 11 years old. Between that and like DMs that I get on Facebook and Instagram, like, please thank your grandmother for me. Sometimes I go into the comments of stuff that people have posted about her. And it is just hundreds of thousands of thank you for your service. And what a brave woman and what an incredible unit. And these women are amazing. And it's not lost on me that we are all still starved. And when I say we, I'm talking about Black and brown people. We are all still starved for those examples, those bright, shining examples, those histories that have been hidden or omitted.
And that some are still trying to omit.
Erase.
Yes.
Even more so. And this is
they're trying to erase the ones that are known, not to mention keep out the ones that are not known yet.
Absolutely. These are outrageous times. And it's almost as if like we've been given this gift in realizing and actualizing these women's histories in real time. And so we now have this responsibility of being torchbearers. And I do so gladly and proudly. And sometimes my friends or my family will say, Tara, are you like, when does this end? Because they'll ask me, they're like, oh, how's it going? How's your grandma? I'm like, good, great. So we're donating her jacket. Her jacket's going to go into the military. Women's museum. And they're like, wait a minute, stuff is still happening. And I was like, yeah, like this doesn't.
this is not an event.
Thank you.
It's not an event with a beginning time and an end time.
It's history in motion. And I think it's about telling and retelling when you think about the beautiful heritage of storytelling from the beginning of time, right? The only way that history stays alive is if you tell and retell. And so I consider myself, it's a responsibility that I accept gladly. I am proud to be amongst the ranks of someone like yourself, Doc. Like this is huge. We have such incredible histories to tell, but also this incredible DNA. And I think in some way, shape, or form, we hit the lottery with all of this. So people are just like, oh, you know, play Powerball. That's cool. But like, I feel like I've already hit the lottery. And how do we ensure that other people understand? I just don't want their service to have been in vain. And right. It's enough for them that they help their country, but that's not enough for me.
It's foundational for so much, and it's important that we make sure that others, the younger generations, know that.
Absolutely.
Not only know, but understand it, that it's not just words.
Yes.
So yeah. It's been inspiring to see like my daughter and my nieces and nephews, you know, that next generation say, wow, Grandma did this, they did that. You know, the whole discovery process. Because they only know the grandparents as old people.
Yes.
You know, telling them to do this or to stop doing that. Yes. You know, and it's like, oh, wow. And then we're still discovering, you know, every day I'm always discovering something new as I go back and look more into my mother's records and discovering different things. And she's just like, oh, wow. You know, it's just amazing. And it gives you an opportunity to rethink your relationships. So it's fantastic. So it's a significant honor for Cynthia and all of these women to receive the Congressional Gold Medal. What was her reaction when she found out?
I'm laughing because it's the same every single time. So again, when you know we talk about her stripes, and she's still not happy. She's still not happy that it's just the one. And she says, "I deserve more." And I say, "Yes, you do, but you're getting the Congressional Gold Medal of Honor." And she looks at me and she's like, "Okay." Because again, those things really don't matter to her. But and what she keeps on going back to is, why do people want to know my story? And then she stops and she says, "Oh, is this because I'm one of the only ones left?" So she gets that she's sort of outliving a lot of people. But beyond that, she just, again, it's the reason that she didn't talk about these things to begin with. She doesn't understand the fuss because this is something that was it was an obligation that she fulfilled, and it was duty. And that's it. So, like, and you know, my hope is that they, as I understand it, the design was approved for the medal.
They were working on it as of Friday. I know they're still working on it.
Like, I mean, I would personally love for this medal to be given to them in this
While they're
current
still here. While they're
administration
still here.
while they're still here, but also within the current administration, because who knows where this is all going to go in 2 years, and that's another conversation. But like, I just so she doesn't get it. She doesn't get the fuss. But if she's but she does. It's weird. And it, again, she's sort of like in and out of lucidity sometimes. But when she's having a good day or she's having a good moment, she gets feisty. And when she starts talking about the war, and she gets sort of like adamant about, you know, protection of the country and who they were fighting against. I see that fire and that spark in her. And in her last interview, she said something about, you know, this is a man's war. This meaning this is a war created by men, and a very special group of women were put in place to help fix the things, which I'd never heard her talk about before. So there, you know, there's that other lens on it. But yeah, no, I mean and she's been given, oh my goodness, like last year, she was given the key to the city. She lives in Yonkers. She was given the key to the city. She was recognized. So April 19th is officially Crescencia Garcia Day in the state of New York.
It's a birthday.
It is her birthday. They had a big celebration for her last year for her 102nd. And so New York State, this in the state of Yonkers, it's Crescencia Garcia Day. She was given declaration and proclamations by all of these politicians. And like even I think the state of Oregon, someone, a mayor in the state of Oregon sent her this beautiful commendation and medal. And the hits just keep on coming. And I think it's kind of lovely. And all she wants is to sneak in some candy. She loves to sip on her Coca-Cola. And she's still very, 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 very proud. But she shirks the spotlight because that again, that's not why that she's not in it for the fame and the glory. I want her, I want it for her. And not for me, but just for the unit. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm so happy that these women are getting, are they're being recognized on a stage when they talked about the amount of human beings that have ever received a Congressional Gold Medal, and to know that George Washington is one of them,
Right.
right? And that their your mom and my grandma are among those ranks. I'm just like,
So
what?
only 200 awards have been given in the history of the country, and no other military women's army military unit has ever received one. So that's pretty special.
Amazing.
I have just a few more questions as we wrap up tonight. What do you think about her decision to serve her country, given the level of racism in America at that time?
Like everything else in her life, it was a bold move. But I also, when I think about the climate in the country at the time, when you saw sort of what was happening and how Hitler was rising to power, I mean, personally, I probably would have been like frozen in my boots. I like to think that I'd be as brave as she was, but I don't know about that. Because that scares the heck out of me when I even watch movies about that stuff now. Like it's heart-wrenching. But you know, to transfer that fear into action, is the difference between, you know, ordinary people and then heroes. And so that's it's not for the faint of heart, and I feel like that was just, but it's still, I think it was just a generation, because it was a call to arms, and so many people answered that call. So, you know, she's not unique in that, but I'm super proud that she, as a woman, decided to do that when she could have very well stayed behind, even in helping in the war effort from here, right? But the fact that she decided to go overseas to do that, I think is extra special.
So, given where the country is now, do you think she'd make the same choice again to serve the
Oh,
nation?
heck yeah. She, from what she discerns of politics here and there, you know, because she kind of sort of still knows what's going on. Like, you know, we did a FaceTime with Joe Biden last year, and she knew exactly that the fact that that was Dr. Biden, first lady, she knew exactly who that was. And so I think even more so now, knowing that this is, you know, this is the place where her children were educated, and where her grandchildren are being educated, and where her great-grandchildren are being educated. And I just, she's not a shrinking violet by any stretch of the imagination. She's tough. She's just so tough. And that beginning, her rough beginnings in Puerto Rico, that is her foundation. And she doesn't know how not to face something head on. So yeah,
Okay.
absolutely. Except I think she'd be a little more vocal about it now. Yeah, she is.
So my last question, what lessons from her life story can you share to inspire young Puerto Ricans and African Americans to embrace fear as opportunity in order to shatter glass ceilings and be their best selves?
Oh my goodness. So this is something I do every day,
Okay.
proudly. I mean, when I talk to whether it's candidates in the advertising space or just the creative space in general, right? When I do informational interviews or take on mentorships, as you know, again, someone who entered my industry at an interesting time, what I explain to people, just generally speaking, is in order to create the change, you have to infiltrate. You got to get in there. And there are ways of navigating. And I think for a really long time, I navigated by shrinking myself. But I was young, and I really didn't know myself. So I just sort of like stayed off in the corner, observed quite a bit, and got a lot done sort of behind the scenes. Fast forward to now, and I have a better sense of myself, especially in the last, I want to say, 5 years. I just turned 50, so I'm in an interesting juncture of my life. And now I speak up, and now I say the things, and now I speak my truth, and now I walk in my truth. And the beautiful thing about this new generation, the Z's, as it were, is that they've never not known how to speak their truth. Like I take pages from their books sometimes. And so it's wild. Like I'm like, whoa. Like there's no way that at your stage of your career that I would have had the nerve to bring certain things up, or to claim, to stake my claim, as it were. And they do. And my encouragement to them is just like, you know, you have every right to be here. You belong here. And the minute you get a sense that you don't, tap your mentor on the shoulder, or just tap somebody that you respect on the shoulder, and just do a sort of like a check, and get some reassurance, because it's really easy to sort of to doubt yourself. It's easy to be talked out of something, or sort of like have give in to the negative talk in your brain, because we are human and the doubts come in. And then, you know, I don't know, just take a look at the people around you who have accomplished things. It's easy enough to succumb to doubt and to and to listen to sort of the voices in your head. But at the end of the day, I think what people need to remember is that, you know how they always talk about our ancestors are guiding us. Our ancestors are, we are our ancestors' wildest dreams. And while I am lucky enough to have one of those ancestors walking among us now, and she is living, breathing proof of that, she is my only grandparent left. And when I think about everything that they did up until a certain point to get us all here, I have an obligation to take it over the line. And I can't do that without community. I can't do that without, you know, the people who believe in me, the people that I believe in. And I think part of that is people being vulnerable and opening themselves up and sharing their truth and sharing their stories. I try to do that with everyone that I meet in the appropriate settings. But I think it's important that we share our stories, both our struggles and our victories, and explain that that so much of this is waiting for us and destined for us. And, you know, your grandparent doesn't have to be a war veteran or hero. You know, they could have just held it down and, you know, put someone through school or whatever their path was. But you're sitting here talking to me, you're sitting here, you know, looking at this career path, or you're deciding on a school to attend or whatever it is. And it's just like, our paths are meant to cross. And I think we come across some really incredible, beautiful souls in our lifetimes. And those people sort of help you get through the stuff. And just as an overarching theme, I think for all of this in general, there are plenty of people who've decided that we don't matter or that we don't belong. The more I dig in, the more that I commit to understanding my history and to understanding my heritage and to understanding my lineage, the more I'm convinced that not only do I belong, but I helped to create all of this. And this is as much my world as it is anyone else's. And everybody talks about a legacy and leaving a legacy behind. I don't have children, and I won't. So I look for other ways to leave my mark on this path. And if you live that way every single day, if you use that lens every single day, I don't think you'll fall short of living a life that's worth remembering, if not just for yourself, right?
Wow, that's a very powerful statement. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me tonight and for sharing your story, your family story. I'm very, very grateful.
Doc, you're amazing. Can I just tell you how honored I am to know you? I hope to know you forever.
Thank you so much.
You're stuck with me, Doc. Yep.
Always adding to the family.
We are fam for sure.
To my audience, thank you for listening to Nexus 818 Podcast. I hope you enjoyed our show. If you have questions or topics you'd like us to discuss, or you'd like to be a guest on the show, please email the show at nextus818podcast@gmail.com. That's nextus818podcast@gmail.com. I like to end each show with a favorite reflection. Tonight, I'll share a quote from Rachel Marie Martin. Brave one. There will be a day when you look back and you'll be so proud of all the little steps you took day by day. Because eventually, those steps turned into miles, and you will have accomplished marvelous things. See you for our next show on Wednesday, March 1st at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. You can catch the show on Amazon Music, Anchor, Apple Podcasts, Audible, Google Podcasts, and Spotify.